Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Thanks for tuning into Off Camera. I hope you're enjoying our new season. And if you're new to the show, I just want to let you know that Off Camera is so much more than a podcast. Take a minute and go to offcamera.com. You'll find full episodes of our television show and the unique, limited edition Off Camera magazine. And you can support Off Camera by going to the store and picking up one of these limited edition magazines, or one of our t-shirts, or one of our premium subscriptions. So take a minute and check it out. You'll be glad you did. Now let's get on with the show. Hey folks, welcome to another episode of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And for you sports fans out there, today I have a real treat for you because I sit down with legendary sportscaster Dan Patrick. Dan Patrick has built two sports broadcasts into two of the most popular and respected shows on national radio and television, ESPN's flagship SportsCenter, and now, The Dan Patrick Show. I've been a fan of Dan and his shows for a long time. A while back, he called me to let me know he was a fan of Off Camera. He thought he was just giving me a nice compliment about the show. He didn't know he was also giving me an opening to snag him as a guest on this show. Dan is a great host because he has an innate sense for what makes a great story. And Dan's own story is compelling in its own right. After 18 years at ESPN, he took a major risk in leaving one of the most enviable jobs in broadcasting to start his own show. He found himself in a unique position, competing against his old network and having to sell a product, himself. Luckily, he was working with quality merchandise. Dan's interviews are some of the best out there, so I was fascinated to hear how he creates great conversations, and especially how he handles asking tough guests some tough questions. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Sam.
So I thought we should start with your height and weight.
6'3", 201.
Okay, there you go.
And you?
Well, 6'2", 185. Although I think I'm 6'1 now. I feel like
I stood
I
next
shrunk.
To you. It felt like you're fudging a little bit.
Yeah, maybe I'm 6'1 now.
Yeah.
And I swear I used to be 6'2. Do you think people shrink when they turn, you know, 30, 32?
Well, as you said, you've been carrying this show on your shoulders.
That's right.
And that's why, I mean, you could be 5'10 in a couple of years.
That's right. You saw me turning on the lights.
You did it all. You did my makeup today.
I know.
I appreciate that.
That's a humbling experience that will shrink you internally. Well, how did the height and weight thing start? Because, you know, for people who don't know, a lot of people who call into your radio show will, unprompted, just tell you their height and weight.
I worked with a guy, Rob Dibble, who pitched for the Cincinnati Reds.
Okay.
And he was obsessed with how big he was. You know, he was in great shape. And so he'd always tell you that 6'4", you know, I'm up to 242. And so he'd always update me on the radio show. And the audience is so intelligent, they just said, we're going to update you on our height and weight, too. And then we had a height and weight bell, so when you call in, you know, it's Jim in Schenectady, 6'2", and, you know, three spins. And I, you know, hit the height and weight bell. And then you move forward. Instead of saying, hi, hello, and how are you?
First-time caller, long-time listener.
Just get right to the question. Give me your height and weight, and then we move on.
Right. And I have to say, listening to your show, I feel good about it, because there's a lot of, like, 5'8", 225s.
Well, you'll get women who will call in, and they may give you their height, not necessarily their weight.
Right.
Some will give you breast size.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, there you go. I didn't give you my breast size.
No, but
we can talk about that later.
Thank you.
So I want to just sort of set the scene for how we met, because I thought it was rather unique in this day and age. I got a message on my cell phone, and you would track down my cell phone number through DirecTV and just called to say, hey, I like what you're doing. I'm enjoying the show. No need to call me back.
Yeah.
And that meant a lot to me. And I don't know if people do that enough, you know? And so I called you back, and we sort of developed a little back and forth, and it's been really nice.
I just thought, a lot of times you hear praise, but you don't know if it's real or not. And I just wanted you to know it came from a good place, that I just want to say, hey, you're doing a great job. Don't call me back. You know, just keep doing what you're doing. And then we've had subsequent conversations and had dinner together. And yeah, I even had trepidation about coming on because I watched the show and I didn't want to screw up the show that I watch.
Right.
So well, that's my goal. I didn't want to do that. But
Well, you have some to be people, careful. You know, you call someone with a television show and yeah, you end up on their show.
I know, but a lot of times somebody will tell you something and you don't know if they're saying it just because in the moment, if they meet you, they'll go, oh, I love your show.
Right.
I just wanted you to know that it came from a place where I'm just a viewer who actually had your phone number and wanted to let you know.
Well, it was flattering and it led to this. And you know, for people too young to understand, I should just say this, that I think that you know, through SportsCenter and through just your take on the world of sports, you have played a big part in the way that we watch and view sports and talk about sports. And I think a lot of people don't realize that SportsCenter and those kind of shows haven't been around forever. They have a fairly short history in the lifeline of television.
Yeah.
And you know, to be able to do that and then go create a completely original radio show and sort of transcend the sports world to where you get guests. I mean, you've had George Clooney, you've had Will Ferrell, you've had Jerry Seinfeld. You've had all kinds of people on your show. It's pretty remarkable what you've done, and I feel like in that world, you are probably the shining example of you can make a bigger world out of something that people see only in one way, you know. But I guess my initial question when I wanted to have you on here is, I wondered what the stakes were when you were starting out. If the expectations felt low.
I understood sort of where we were at ESPN, of what it was. I didn't know what it would be, but I knew that it was a platform to do sports for 24 hours a day, which was unheard of.
Right.
So I left CNN, where I was a sports reporter at an all-news network, to be able to go to ESPN. And then once I got there, you sort of realized, I get to do this. I get to watch this. I get to be involved in this. And we were kind of cordoned off from the rest of the world. We're in Bristol, Connecticut. We didn't know the ratings. You didn't know who was watching. I didn't know if I was getting better, if I was any good at what I was doing. I just knew I was having fun. And then Keith Olbermann came in, and that's when we just sort of decided, not through discussion, that let's have some fun. Let's do this differently. And we were very different, so you could take 30 minutes of each one of us. But you know, if our personality was for an hour, maybe you couldn't. But it combined, it meshed, we had fun together, we trusted each other. He was a great teammate. And all of a sudden you're saying, why can't we have fun with this highlight? Why can't we throw in something? Why can't we have a catchphrase? And management fought us all the way.
They did.
Did not like it at all, not at all. And which made it even more enjoyable because there was a Eddie Haskell feel to it, is
right.
We're going to try to get away with this. And we were on at 11 o'clock at night, so we assumed our bosses were probably in bed. So we even made fun of our bosses. And then we started to realize people in the building almost became fans of ours
right.
Before anybody else did that we knew of. And I remember when I finally felt like maybe people were watching, when I met Bill Murray, and we were doing a pub crawl, and I meet Bill Murray, and he walks into the antique boutique in the Village, and he comes out with a bright orange tie. And he said, see, it's not that hard. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, remember you said the toughest thing about being the Tennessee coach is you got to get orange ties to go along with every suit you wear? And I'd said that on SportsCenter when a coach got the job at Tennessee, and I said, that might be the toughest job to find that kind of orange. And Bill went in and pulled it out of this antique boutique and gave it to me. So
no
then
kidding.
You're going, I was like shocked. I went, oh, wow, somebody's watching.
Yeah. Well, when you talk about it, I almost think of, I don't know, it's that counter-establishment thing where you are part of the establishment, but you're fighting against it while you're part of it.
We almost got fired. We thought we were getting fired one day. And my philosophy is the more wood paneling in a room, the more trouble you're in. So we go in and we had to go up to the second floor and it was all wood paneling, even on the ceiling. And I went, we're in trouble. And my boss banged on the table and, you know, he was like, you guys are not going to do this anymore. And you're going to be, you know, team players and stop calling it the big show. We called it the big show because we mocked ourselves. We didn't know who was watching.
Right.
So then, you know, he said, and you're going to say, this is SportsCenter as you go to commercial break. So be careful what you ask for. Because when we would go to commercial break, coming up, we'll have highlights of the Indians and Ken Griffey Jr. homers again. And we'll also check in with, you know, the Boston Bruins. This is SportsCenter. So we rubbed it in.
Right.
Then they created a campaign called This is SportsCenter based off of that, where they did an ad campaign about SportsCenter called This is SportsCenter. So
was it that where it was like they thought they were defining the channel and you ended up defining
the
channel?
Thought that that SportsCenter itself was most important, that we were ancillary. You know, we're the ones on
it
the assembly line.
Hosts.
Yeah, we're doing the brake shoes on the assembly line.
Right.
They're the car, and they're the luxury car, and which I understood that. But we still respected the process. We took great pride in our writing. We had to write everything in breaking stories. But there was also the counterbalance of, you just did a serious story, now you can do highlights. Have fun with the highlights. It's sports. It's, you know, how can you say don't have fun? We only knew the people in there. So the camera people, and then it would be Keith. And then it would be Howie Schwab in research. And if you got them to laugh, then you felt like somebody out there in America is laughing.
Right.
But you didn't know.
When you started doing it, did it just fit you like a comfortable suit? I mean, did you say, oh, this is what I'm meant to do?
I was meant to do it. I had no other, when I was 12, I knew that I wanted to do it. I didn't know how to do it. But I used to cut out the pictures in Sports Illustrated. I'd consume the magazine on Thursday, cut out the pictures, put them on my wall, and then my dad would get home, and then he'd open up the Sports Illustrated, and there'd be like, you know, he'd go. So he brought me my own copy of Sports Illustrated. And I went to college. I had nothing to fall back on.
Did you ever think you'd be a pro athlete?
Basketball or baseball, I held dream, you know, hope that I could do something like that.
What was the, do you remember the defining moment when you said, oh, yeah, I'm not going to be able to do this on a pro level?
Even on a college level. You know, I got to college, and that's where I remember guarding a guy, Tyrone Too Small Jones. He was 5'9", out of Eastern High in D.C., and I went out to guard him. And it was one of those where I got it. And he was by me. And then the coach started yelling at me. If you've ever seen the Robbie Benson movie, One-on-One.
Yeah.
I'm Robbie Benson without the game-winning jump shot or the good-looking girl. Just the abuse that you took. My coach hated me. I had long hair. It was like Fabio hair without Fabio's face.
Really?
And he called me Golden Boy. And he hated me. And I was going to show him. I kept growing my hair until he was going to let me play. Hell, I could have been Rapunzel. I was Samson after a while. And I went, what am I doing? And I transferred after 2 years at Eastern Kentucky. And I went home and I went to the University of Dayton, and then I got an opportunity doing part-time work at a local station in Dayton, Ohio. And that's where, you know, the fuse was lit.
And you just felt it like, oh yeah, this is where I'm...
No, because I lost the job.
Oh, you did?
I was up for the weekend job at Channel 2.
I want to know who the guy was that fired you from doing sports on the radio.
His name is Lou Prado. And we were at Channel 2, and I was up against a guy, Ken Kettering. And Ken Kettering was he was a Ken doll. He lived up to his name. Good-looking guy, family man, and they chose him. And I remember getting called in to the news director's office. And it was just, I was up for this job. I was going to do weekends. And I think he says, I'm not sure what I'm going to tell Ken. As if he's got to let Ken down because I just got this job. In my mind, I got the job. So I'm saying, hey, you know, it's going to be tough. And he said, well, you're taking it well. And I went, I'm taking it. I said, I didn't get the job? He goes, no, I'm giving it to Ken. I had a party planned for me at Flanagan's Pub. I walk in, people are yelling, hooting, and hollering. I said, I didn't get the job. They're like, yeah, oh, come on, stop bullshit. I said, I didn't get the job. So I said, but, you know, we got a keg, so we might as well drink it. Fast forward to I was feeling sorry for myself. I was 27, and I had an ex-girlfriend in Atlanta, and she said, why don't you come down? CNN's hiring. So I flew down there. I took a tape with me, you know, audition tape, and I got a job at CNN the last day I was there, and they said, can you, you know, come down here in 2 weeks? And I said, yeah. So I lost the job in Dayton, Ohio, and got a job at CNN. Stayed there 5.5 years, called up ESPN and said, do you know who I am? My boss said, yep. You want to hire me? Yep. That was a Friday. I went up Tuesday and took the job. Didn't negotiate. I just took whatever they gave me and moved my wife up to Connecticut.
Wow. So paint a picture for me of how your life changed at that point, or how entrenched you were in that show being your life.
Well, sadly, I was too entrenched, because I remember that there was an insecurity that you have anyway when you're in TV, and they didn't hand out compliments. Like, they kept you on edge a little bit.
What do you mean an insecurity? Just that the job could go away at any time?
You just felt like you were never fully embraced, like, you're our guy, or you and Keith are our show, the signature show.
You're kidding me.
No, there was always that feeling of uneasiness there.
Huh.
So when you add all of that, and I put all my time and effort in, instead of with my wife and my kids, I had 4 kids under the age of 7, and so I'm working second shift, and that was all I thought about was work. And so I became too immersed in it, and I would, whatever they asked me to do, I'd be there. You know, holidays, anniversaries, you name it. Whatever you want, I was going to be there. And all you're waiting for is feedback. Like, you want somebody to say you're doing a good job. And so it played with me for a long time, where I was sort of chasing something and I didn't know what I was chasing. But when I was with Keith, those 5 years, as enjoyable as anything I've ever done TV-wise.
Really?
Yes. But I was loyal to the product, because we saw the product grow and become something. And I never wanted to leave it. Everybody who was doing SportsCenter, from, you know, Chris Berman to John Saunders and Chris Fowler, and I mean, they all left to do other things.
And you stayed.
I was the last one there.
Yeah.
And you just bring in newer talent.
I totally can sympathize with the idea that you're trying so hard to be good at something, and it's a lucky opportunity. I'm sure everyone you meet at the time is, wow, you're on.
You can't complain if you're on SportsCenter, because they'll be like, what are you complaining about?
Right, and yet, it's obviously there's something out of whack there if you're giving your whole life to something other than your family, and you're young enough still to not maybe even understand the value of that time or how quickly time passes.
You know what? It breezed by, unfortunately. That's why I always hated winning an award, because it meant that I was really good at being on the air but not good at being a father or husband.
So do you see your awards as evidence of early regrets in some ways?
Yes.
Huh.
Yeah, yeah. It ate away at me, because all I wanted was the respect in the industry. You didn't have to give me an award. It was just that you respected what I did. I did it professionally. But it was 8 years ago, and I'm going to sign a 5-year deal. So I'd been at ESPN 18 years. And prior to that, I'd had a boss who, Mark Shapiro, he acknowledges the story, so I can say it. He'll get a kick out of it. But I was thinking of, you know, leaving, or, you know, I was trying to get more money, and he said to my agent, he's over the hill and he'll never get another job any other place. That was the negotiating tact by him.
So knowing that your agent would tell you.
Yes. So I'm thinking, gosh, I got to resign, which I did. The next contract that came up, I'm going to sign for 5 more years. I had a new boss. That morning, my wife goes, you know, the kids are going to be out of the house when this deal's on. Because I'd always say, you got a new deal and new responsibilities. And she'd always say, well, you get more money, but you're going to work harder, which is true. So that morning she said, I said, you know, I'm going to sign this deal. She said, they're going to all be out of the house. And I 55-minute drive to work. And I got there and I went upstairs and I walked into my boss's office, and he had a nervous tic all the time. He'd go like this. He said, so, what the fuck are you going to do? And my wife's words came into my head. And I said, I'm going to leave it. And he said, all right, we'll get the contract drawn up. What? I said, I'm going to leave it. You're going to quit? I said, yeah. So I'm convincing myself in front of my boss that I'm leaving.
Did you know before you spoke that you were quitting?
No. Because I was afraid to make the jump. Like, I had opportunities. I didn't know what to do. And I thought at my age at that time, and you turn 50 and you're thinking, God, I can't do it. I got kids and weddings and, you know, all this stuff. And I just remember when I got there, and I walked outside and I said, hon, I'm coming home. And she said, okay. I said, I'm coming home. She goes, okay. I said, hon, I just quit. She goes, we'll sell the house if we have to. Boom, wave of emotions.
When you tell him that and he says he can't believe it, or he, you know, what is his reaction right after?
Well, he gave me a take it or leave it.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
And like offers expires right
that's
now.
It, yeah. And I wasn't going to be a party to that. But I think I had outgrown them or they'd outgrown me. I mean, it was time.
But was your exit, were they resentful? Was it?
Yes. They went out of their way to make it very difficult for me.
They did?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's got to be tough to put so much of your life into something and then, you know, have them treat you so poorly on the exit.
But it's the best thing that ever happened.
Why is that?
Because every single day I thought about it. Every single day. How do I make this great? How do I beat them? It motivated to this day. And my relationship is so much better with ESPN. But it took 8 years. Because I said, hey, if that's the way you want to play, all I wanted was an even level playing field. That's all I asked for. Just if you want to compete with me, make it level. And they didn't. You know, there were some tactics that weren't above board. And I said, all right, it's going to motivate me. And it does to this day. We were doing the show, my radio show, out of my attic.
Right. So, okay. So take me back to, so you come home, you call your wife, you say you're coming home. You come home.
I come home, pull in the driveway, and my youngest daughter's out there. And I don't know how old Molly was at the time, but she was really young. And I thought, oh, my wife sent her out there. God, that's great. You know, welcome home. This is a Norman Rockwell painting. You know, I've come home and the kids are at the dinner and my wife's got an apron on and we're having, you know. So my daughter goes, hey, Dad. I said, hey, Molly. Supposed to be honest with you. And I thought, okay, just tell me you love me and I'm glad to be home. You sure? I said, yeah. I'm like, God, she's milking this. Like, even if it hurts your feelings, and I'm going, how can I love you, hurt my feelings? And she said, all right, you got a booger in your nose, Dad. And then she walked away. So I walked inside, I go, what the hell just happened? And she goes, my wife goes, what? I go, Molly came out, and all she said was, you got a booger in your nose. She goes, I told her to go out and say, we love you, and we're glad you're home. So then that's when reality hit. I came in, sat down, and my kids all go, and they were dead silence. And they were like, is this a good thing, Dad? I said, it's a great thing. They started banging the table with the silverware. And I said, I did the right thing.
Wow. You know, I was watching your interview with Adam Sandler, and he asked you if you had to choose TV or radio. And you said, I could give up TV, but I can never give up radio.
Yeah.
And that's interesting to me from a guy who started on CNN very young and then went to SportsCenter and built their whole career on TV. What is it about radio that you knew, or that, like, why?
I grew up listening to it. And I love that I can create something in your mind. And I'm fascinated with art. So if I have the ability in my little world to create something in your mind, that's powerful. And if it's something that keeps you in your car, that's powerful. If I'm asking a question and I'm getting that answer, and you lean closer to the radio, I've just been fascinated by that. And whether it was music or talk, sports, play-by-play, radio is a medium that I was meant for. And I never thought I was good-looking enough to be on TV. So coupled with that, I knew I had a radio voice. But you didn't know if you had a face for radio too, so I wanted to make sure I was really good at something.
People must have thought, he's nuts. Like, he's going from SportsCenter, and he wants to go do a radio show in his attic.
Well, Rick Riley.
Because most people want to go the other way.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Rick Riley from Sports Illustrated had the great line. He called me the Shelley Long of sportscasters, because Shelley Long left Cheers.
Left Cheers.
Yeah. And Riley went to ESPN and at that time, and he labeled me the Shelley Long of, he called it one of the five worst things that any sports broadcaster's done, or some label like that. And what nobody knew and believed is I had to go home to be around my kids, just to hit the reset button. I mean, I had to get reacclimated. It took a couple of years to just settle in and not do a damn thing, but pick up kids or go to the grocery store, do laundry or whatever it was. I needed it badly.
Yeah. Do you think a lot of people that were in your position of success on television, they just never make that decision and their lives are less rich because of it? I mean, it's such a golden carrot or a thing that once you get it, it's hard to let go of it.
Yes.
And I would imagine there's not a lot of people that can make that decision.
People said I was crazy. Crazy. It was humbling. I had 12 radio stations when I started.
And you were in your attic.
In my attic.
What was like the most reckless or scariest part of that transition for you? Like, was it financial or was it?
Yes.
It was.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Yep. We were getting short on cash. I would be the last guy to cash my check, but I never told the guys I worked with, because they took a chance to join me. But I'm in my attic, and I'm with four other guys. There's no cameras. It's just we're doing a national radio show to 12 affiliates. And now I never felt better. I never, even if it failed, it was my name. And I did something. I came home, and my wife loved the fact that I was at home, that, you know, she would be cooking downstairs and the guys would come up in the morning at 7 a.m. and, you know, she'd be in a bathrobe, you know, breakfast with my kids. She
sounds
loved
like a them. Startup. It sounds like
it was, you know, a startup. And what happened is we were in some financial trouble. I went outside. I was at the bar that I go to, and I walked outside and I said, I'm going to call DirecTV. They don't have sports. And I was watching the Masters, and they had these, the DirecTV carries these channels about the Masters. And I thought, you know, they're sort of in sports. And I found the guy, Chris Long, and I just said, hey, Chris, I'm Dan Patrick. Do you know who I am? He goes, yeah. I said, I'd like to be in business with you. And he said, okay. I said, I'd like to simulcast my radio show. All right, how much is it going to cost? I go, like, it's one of those where you go, holy shit, he's actually thinking of doing, I don't know, but I'll find out. So I had to go to the guy I started this with, and we had to come up with a price tag for them to buy it. And then next thing I know, we move in above the bar that I go to in an old dance studio. They put in all these cameras. We had 3 months window, and we ended up going on the air. Like, it happened so quickly, and then the management said, well, you can't have those guys on that you're working with. I go, if they're not on, then I don't want to do it.
Really?
Oh, yeah, because they were my friends. It was almost like you're doing radio to an audience that gave you feedback immediately. And they hold me accountable. We have fun. And I just said, I can't do it the old way. Because they're guys who do it, and they do it in their own way, and they're successful. I just wanted to do a show that was going to be fun every day. And that's what I said to Chris Long at DirecTV. I said, I need you to stay out of it. And he said, I promise I will. And 8 years, I mean, he doesn't get involved at all. Never. Doesn't
I mean, that
say,
poor guy, we tell him the same thing. He's not allowed to visit any of his shows.
Yes, but that's where he's so good, is that he trusts you. And that's all I said. Just trust me. I'll make you proud. And yeah, I could give up TV. I could continue to do this, because it doesn't feel like TV. It's radio.
Well, you are a student of the art of the interview, the art of the conversation. And obviously, when you started your radio show, you had to really like interviewing became a much bigger part of your life at that point. What is the art of your job when you are interviewing, when you are talking to people? The things, the intangibles that people may think, oh, I could do that and they couldn't, or the, you know, the things you've discovered that make it more than A plus B equals C.
I think you have to be curious. If I really care about your answers, that's the key. If I'm interested in you, then I'm curious about your answers. So you start with that, being a good listener. And the more you talk, the more you give me, the more I can now play off of that if I'm curious about what your answers are.
You know, I watched you interview Ray Rice, who was the football player, obviously, that got cut from the Ravens and from the entire NFL after footage of an elevator assault on his wife came to light. And, you know, obviously you're going to ask him the tough questions, and he's on your show to answer the tough questions. But I feel like there was an art to what you did on that in terms of, I mean, all the things you're saying, there's got to be a humanity under it, too. There has to be an empathy for the person sitting in the chair. But let me ask you that. Do you feel like, well, everything's fair game, or do you feel like I have to also be able to put myself in his chair and understand, you know, what I'm asking him to do? Or is it just simply sport to you that I'm going to get this guy talking?
No, because if it's just sport, you're not going to get what you want. But if I say to him, I really feel sorry for your wife because whenever something comes up about this story, she has to relive it. So I've taken it off him to his wife, who he wants to be protective of, who now understands that I do understand a bigger picture here. When do you tell your daughter what you did to mom? So I have to sort of, what part can I take and take it over here to then come back and maybe load up and hit him with something a little stronger? That's what I tried to do. But you also have to be, I do like Ray. But there's also the part, I said, did you ever hit her before that? You know, because I'm curious. It felt like that's happened before when I watched that video. It's not, oh my God, what did I just do? It seemed a little too non-emotional.
Habit.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I wanted to ask him that, because he hadn't been asked that. So to be able to get it in a way of what am I giving my audience? Once again, it's about what the audience takes away from it is the key. I always ask my guys that I work with, the Danettes, I always say, be honest with me, because I want to be better. I want to be great at this. Be honest. Was I fair? And they say, yes, you were fair. Now, there are times when they're saying, you know, you went too far with something. But that was one where they both, you know, all four of the guys said, that was good.
I wonder what it's like from Ray's side coming on in terms of prepping, just assuming, well, I'm going to get out. Like, he's obviously not going on there hoping that you won't ask him those kinds of questions, right? So part of that is just built into the deal.
He knew there was no restrictions. That he knew going in, he was going to come on. He would use that as a vehicle to let people know, rehabilitated, don't forget about me, maybe I get another chance. I understood that.
Right. Do you sort of spell that out to people, that there's never any restrictions?
Oh, I won't have you on if there's restrictions.
So it's just straight up?
It's not fair to the audience.
Right.
I was going to do an interview with Barry Bonds in spring training probably 11 years ago, and there was some kind of PR release that he was changing his image and being a little bit more open, and so I said, well, all right, let's get him on. So they're ready to hand him the phone, and the PR department said, oh, by the way, no steroid questions. And I said, deal's off. I can't. Then the audience is like, oh, you're afraid to ask the tough question. It's not fair to the audience, which is who you serve. Not, hey, I'm going to be friends with Barry Bonds.
Right.
I would be respectful to him, but Lance Armstrong came on. And he knew I was loading up. I mean, I was coming in, and I wanted to know, you know, why. You know, when did ego take over? And because I wanted to get into the inner workings there.
Yeah.
Like how, now Bonds, of course, has denied all this. Lance has not, or, you know, Lance said, here it is, you know, all right, you got me. Then you can get in and let people, because we're curious.
For sure.
I like to think I'm going to ask the questions they want answers to. And I'm going to hopefully be fair when I ask the questions.
I wonder if you, you know, doing this so long, can you tell when an interview, when it starts to go well? Do you feel like you now have the wherewithal to be able to chase it in the right
and
path?
When it goes bad.
And when it goes bad. So you can see those signs that they're coming. What is the killer?
Answers start getting shorter, quicker.
Okay, so you can tell, like...
Like, yes, because they have a clock in their head of how long they're going to go or where are we going with this. And you can hear it. Another trick is that you'll get... Coaches will do it. They'll talk longer because they know they're only on for a certain amount of time. Because of your show, you got a 7-minute window. They'll talk longer to reduce the questions you ask.
That's a politician trick, too.
Yeah. But coaches do that because they're politicians as well. And that's where you have to jump in sometimes and try to take them down a different road there.
Do the guests get any sort of prep from your staff of he may jump in and that's just the deal with radio?
No.
Nothing. It's just...
No, because I think if you come on, that you come on with a reasonable understanding of what we are.
Right.
I like to have fun. But I also, you know, sometimes it's a serious topic.
Sure.
And sometimes it's a goofy and serious topic in the same conversation. But that's a conversation. And that's the key is I don't like interviewing. I like having a conversation. And that's the difference. I go into it with everybody of let's have a conversation here.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because we try not to use the word interview around here.
Yeah, I don't like it.
I like conversation because I feel like an interview is a one-sided thing. And the worst interviewers don't have a connection between questions and answers. It's not a flow. It's just, you know, let me take information from you and fill my list.
Yeah, but even if you say interview, you feel like you have to sit up a little straighter.
Yeah, exactly.
If you say rap conversation, you lean back.
That's why we have these leaning back chairs.
That's very comfortable.
Yeah, well, okay, so... you know, you've had a lot of non-sports people on your show, and I wonder if with your experience and your skills and the culture you sort of developed about how you have conversations, does the sports world ever feel limiting?
No, because the sports world branches out into race, religion, politics, you know, cultural, movies. I mean, these guys want to be other things. The fact that Tiger and Michael Jordan weren't involved in politics at the height of their careers. Ali and Jim Brown and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, they were. They want to be in music. You know, they want to be rappers. They want to be in movies. So you have everything there.
Right.
I'm able to talk race and religion far more easily than somebody who would be on CNN or Fox because you can. I mean, race is such an important... It's there in sports.
Yeah.
In a variety of ways. Cam Newton is this. Well, is he this because he's a black quarterback, not just somebody 6'6", really talented? You know, he doesn't act the way Montana does or Marino does. So?
Is that a race discussion?
Yes. Yes, and there are tinges always there. Like, and then I listen just to hear sometimes when you're, where are we going with this? But look, it's dangerous to go down that road. You've had people who have been fired because of their comments about race.
Yeah.
Jimmy the Greek, Rush Limbaugh. This is sports-related stuff.
Well, it's funny because I think that a lot of people could say that filter of sports limits your viewpoint. But you're saying looking at life through the filter of sports actually gives you a wide enough spectrum that you don't feel like, gosh, I could be on another level, another stage. Because sometimes, you know, you have guys on that are... you know, or women who are outside that world a little bit, but they come on and it's their chance to talk sports.
Well, we had the late Glenn Frey on 8 months before he died, and I just wanted to talk about the Eagles, and he wanted to talk about the Detroit Tigers. So you have this kind of push me, pull me, like we have Taffy here, and I want to ask him about the Eagles, and he keeps waiting for me to talk about the Tigers, you know? And So it made for interesting conversation of who was going to give in first.
But I wonder, in that interview setting, like, there must be times when you feel like, ah, oh, I blew it, or I didn't get what I wanted, or sure, I didn't prep in the right direction. Do you have those while you're actually live? Do you have a self-critic, or is there a critical voice in your head that you have to sometimes squash to get through something, or have you made peace with that kind of thing?
I haven't made peace with it, because I'm critical of the interview during the interview.
During the interview?
Yeah. There's interviews that have followed me for days where you're just, like, you just could have done better. I started here, and I was trying to be too cute. They didn't get me. Like, it just, there are times when, but you have to do that, because I've never had the perfect interview. So you want to have that perfect interview where you just, and I'll never have it.
Right.
Because you don't, like, part of you wants it, but you don't want it, because you keep going for it. Like, what am I going to get? What do I want out of this? Did I get it? I'm always going to say, and I drive my guys crazy, I'll say, God, I should have asked. And they'll go, that, it's done.
Really?
Yeah, oh, yeah. But I've done everything, and like that, being competitive, that, how do you win? You know, there's no score that you have when you're doing this. There's no score at the end of this interview where you go, yep, Sam had 12.
Yeah, no.
Dan had 9, or there's nothing. You don't know that. It's more of a feeling where you say, I think that was pretty good. And that's what I'm willing to accept. I think it was pretty good.
Do you think that's the actual draw of sports in general, is that there is a score at the end of it?
We like to have a winner and a loser.
Right. You know, my producing partner was watching TV a few weeks ago, and his 8-year-old daughter came up and said, Dad, why do you watch football? And it sort of stumped him. The question stumped him. You know, and he had to think, well, why do I sit here in front of a TV watching other men run around on a field for 3 hours?
No.
Have you asked yourself that? Why sports for you? Why does it keep being interesting for you?
I wouldn't even know where to start to examine it. But I love a story. It's the same thing when we have movies where you go, boy, I love Bull Durham. What a great baseball movie. And I said, it's not a baseball movie. It's about a relationship. It's really about relationships. They use baseball as the metaphor. Or, you know, throw out Rudy. What's Rudy about? It's about sticking up for your teammate. It's about relationships. That's what I watch sports for, is what is the story? It could be somebody who comes out of nowhere to do something you'd never heard of, like Malcolm Butler of the Patriots with the interception that turned out to be the greatest individual play in Super Bowl history. Nobody knew who Malcolm Butler was, so you have that great story. Peyton Manning walking off for the final time in a Super Bowl is a great story. That's all I want, because you can tell a story. You can tell a story for days. And if you have that, and that's how I watch a game. I don't root for a team. I root for a story.
You know, Vin Scully said it once. He said, I find something that I've never seen before in every baseball game. And that's a lot of games.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And I think that's what I'm looking for as well. The names change, the years change, but there's still that same process of somebody's going to do something that I haven't seen. Or it might be in a variation of something I'd seen, which I can use as a cross-reference. But as long as there's a story attached to it, that's the fun part. Bill Buckner in 1986 had the ball go through his legs. And I remember visiting Bill Buckner years later just to talk about it. And I told him the story of, I was down by the Red Sox locker room waiting to interview them. They're winning the World Series. Who would have thought the Red Sox would win the World Series? So Buckner had just committed the error. I don't see it because I'm right by the locker room. I want to get into the locker room because they're going to close out the Mets. I just hear this cacophony of sounds in, like, I never heard before at Shea Stadium. It's thunderous. It shakes. And somebody said the Red Sox just lost. Buckner goes in and sits down and answers the questions, every question. And years later, when I interviewed him, I told him, I interviewed you and I didn't see that play. And he said, I didn't see it either. He missed the ball. But just to have, like, once again, it's a story. So the first person I had on my radio show after the Red Sox won in 2004 was Bill Buckner. And he said, I don't want anything, this doesn't let me off the hook. I don't, you know. And I said, Bill, I just want you to on. And in some way, I wanted to have people understand this. A guy had 2,800 hits in his career, was really a great baseball player. And he shouldn't be in purgatory just because it's your purgatory that you want him in. And to have that, it was more than just an error. It became a story, and it became a story about his life.
Maybe that's the failure of story, is that it needs to reduce things down to simple events. The version of the story that everyone's going to remember is the ball going through his legs.
Well, he said that, you know, his kids, he had to move out of Boston. He moved to Star, Idaho. And he had to move because his kids were being abused. And he said, it's not like I didn't try to catch it or want to catch it.
Right, of course.
I mean, I made a mistake. And we vilify as if, you know, you caused my heartache, and I'm not going to let you forget. They suffer the ultimate heartache. It'll never leave Bill Buckner.
Yeah.
Scott Norwood of the Buffalo Bills missed that field goal in the Super Bowl. It never leaves. We move on. They're not allowed to.
Maybe that's sports at its worst.
But we're more passionate about it now. There's more involved in it, more at stake. You know, more people gambling, more people in fantasy. Like, there's more attached to it, what you do and what it means to my life. We never, like, you're not real to me. My fantasy league is real, but you, like, you move on and somebody replaces you. So that's where you're interchangeable, but this is my world, and damn it, don't ruin my world.
See, that sounds like robot culture to me. That scares me. as you know, because this fantasy world, as it gets more technologically advanced, it can usurp reality, right?
Well, they get mad at athletes who don't do well for your fantasy team.
Yeah. Like, is that sort of like one of the precursors to the apocalypse for you? Like,
no.
Does that show, like, maybe there is a sunset on this era of sporting and the joy of being a kid and falling in love with a team? I mean, is that changing?
It's changing because I think kids nowadays, they root for players, not teams.
Right.
Because your player is on my fantasy team, or, you know, whatever it might be. Because these players change teams with free agency. Growing up, my guys that I loved stayed on my team.
Sure.
The loyalty is to that player, not to that team. Whereas growing up, my loyalty was to my team. Even if somebody left, that was still my team. I find that we tend to root for that guy, and not that team.
Well, and to me, that makes for not as good of a story.
Yes.
You know?
Well, when your team wins or loses, the effect that has on you is something that it's tangible, but you don't know how to quantify, because until you're in the moment where you watch something happen, a Packer fan, when the onside kick fails and they lose the chance to go to the Super Bowl, the high of we're going to, we just, like, I do miss that. I miss the pain of loving a team so much that it hurts.
Yeah.
Because I had to give that up because I can't root. And that high of highs when your team wins, just something about who you are, what you are, carry yourself, or when you're dispirited, when your team loses. I remember that's what I fell in love with. Like, things hurt when UCLA lost to Notre Dame and their 88-game winning streak snapped.
Yeah.
I just sat there and watched the TV. I couldn't believe Notre Dame did that to my UCLA Bruins. And I didn't know anybody on the team, but that was my team, Bill Walton. I do miss that.
It's kind of sad. I mean, I grew up a Dodger fan, and my whole life it's been my team. And it started out when I was very, very young, and I would come home from school and go to my grandmother's house, and it was all day games then, and Vin Scully would just be in the house. It's like just another guy in the house. And to this day, I still, whenever I can, try to sit and watch a game all the way through. And I actually think that when DVRs and TiVo came along, it sort of ruined me because I'm too efficient of a person to ignore the button that lets me get through the breaks and the and. But when I have a moment to actually get entranced by a full game, it is a fulfilling experience still. And yet, as an adult, how do we find that time? And I'm sure for you, like, you probably haven't watched a leisurely paced full game in a long time.
Unless I've been in person. I took my kids to see Derek Jeter in his last year because I have four kids. My son is a sports fan, my daughter is not necessarily, but I wanted them to see Derek Jeter.
Right.
I just thought that they should see, and they weren't sure what they were watching, but they knew it was important for me to take them there. So therefore they were respectful to me to see and watch Derek Jeter. And I said, just absorb it, that's all. It was a beautiful sunny day. And one of my daughters said, "What were we watching, Dad?" I said, "You're watching a professional." And that was it. I just, whatever they took away from it, I wanted them to just see somebody do it the right way, without fanfare, go out to your position, and just be a pro. But it was that important for them to go see him.
It's funny how something like that from childhood can sustain you too. You know, whatever bedrock of that love and being so entrenched in those teams, it's obviously stuck with you long enough to still express that passion and have people be drawn to it.
Yeah, there was something that my parents knew. I didn't drink beer until late in my senior year in high school. Like, I was just, they knew where to find me. I was at a basketball court in town shooting hoops, and usually at night by myself. I just do play-by-play and just shoot hoops. And it was like, that was the solitude that I loved. I'd get on my bike. I didn't have a car till I was out of high school. Family of six, so, you know, they didn't miss me if I was out of the house. They just knew where I was. They'd say, "Dan's up at Mason Central shooting hoops," and they'd go up and pick me up, or, you know, they'd drive by and say, "You want food?" And so I grew up in an idyllic situation of being able to follow the big red machine with the, you know, the Reds, and to be able to go to those games and be able to see Pete Maravich play in Cincinnati. And it just, you know, those images stay with you, and to be around it, to feel it, to see it, absorb it. You know, that still to this day resonates.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, in a way, I think I'm attracted to your show and am a fan of yours because you have sort of created this utopia.
I thought you were going to go my acting.
And your acting.
Well, no, I was worried that you were going to go my acting there.
You know, it's not that long.
I purposely was talking long enough so I wouldn't have to do. I was doing the politician thing.
You were doing the coach thing.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like you've taken radio from a place where, I mean, the old radio world, I'm sure when you came in, there were some weird rules, right? And some standard practices of radio that you probably just discovered, well, just like SportsCenter, yeah, we don't have to do it this way.
Yeah.
And now you've created this thing. Is it again the idea of, well, maybe you need to start something new or try a new challenge? Do you feel that way? Or
no, because it's like ESPN, that I kept trying to be better. So I stayed there 18 years. So in my mind, I was only challenging myself. And with this, it's us challenging ourselves. So it's collaborative under the heading of my name. How do we make this better? You know, the guests we have, you know, the opportunities we have, the amount of money that the show raises. Like, it's all intertwined, but it's just us. So it doesn't take long to call roll. And I think the sense of pride that we have with that, and they trust me. Like, now they know that the check's clear, and that's important. But I want them to want to be great too, and that's been the great benefit of, they understand how much it means to me. Every day's a Super Bowl. That's my motto, every day.
And we got to work on your motto.
No, every day's a Super Bowl. It drives them crazy.
That sounds like pressure.
It is, but I just that's how you have to approach it.
Yeah.
That every interview, every segment, every moment, how do we make it great? And I want them to understand, treasure it. Because you have the best job ever in this business. Now, there's a basketball court, there's a full bar, there's a golf simulator, pinball, and to be able to be part of it, and knowing that one day that I'm going to call it quits is, you know, that'll be a tough day.
Well, hopefully we're a long way from
that. Yeah, we're a long way, you know, way, because then I'm going to host this show.
I'll be ready by then.
You will be?
Yeah. How about we just switch for a while?
Ooh.
I get the pinball machine and the golf simulator and the full bar,
but
you get the white room.
Sam, you got to work 3 hours, and you're not used to working 3 hours.
Well, this interview is getting close to that, so we should finish with what we've learned.
Okay, what have we learned? What have you learned?
I've learned that you attempted to repair Bill Buckner's reputation in the city of Boston.
Mm. Okay.
What have you learned?
What did I learn? I learned that you purposely did not bring up my Adam Sandler acting, and that's my next career, but that's for another time. Thanks for joining us.
Well, that'll be the supplementary material that we send out in the pamphlet. Well, you know, we could spend a whole hour on your acting career.
We could. Yeah.
That's
what I learned, is we could have spent an hour talking about my acting.
Instead, we talked about sports and your radio show. We blew it.
I'm acting right now.
So am I.
Yeah.
I'm acting like we better go. Hey, folks, that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed Dan Patrick as much as I did. And listen, if anybody knows Clayton Kershaw out there, tell him to come join me for an episode of Off Camera, and I'll finally learn how to throw a curveball. And hey, make sure to join us next time when I sit down with actress Michelle Monaghan.
I auditioned tons and rejected, you know, still even today, but be patient and persevere and be open to learning and experiencing and grow that thick skin. It's okay if it takes you a few years to get going. Perhaps it's meant to.
We first met long ago when I pitched her on a film role that required her to wear a veil over her face for the entire movie. If you saw her in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang or Mission Impossible 3 or True Detective, you're probably questioning my sanity right now. She's since gained worldwide recognition for her ability to portray more complex and nuanced characters. We'll talk about her very un-Hollywood upbringing and what it's like for someone with no formal training to work alongside some of the biggest names in the business. I also asked how she approached playing not-so-likable characters in Trucker, True Detective, and Hulu's upcoming The Path. You may or may not learn what a splitter is, but she does spill the beans on what scares the pants off Big Bad Iron Man. So, we'll see you next time, off camera.